All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Tuckians? I don't know why I'm focusing on you. How's it going? What's happening out there? The paperback of Waiting for the Punch is now available in stores, folks. Or you can go to markmaronbook.com and order a copy from wherever you like to order books. Also, the Across the Divide event. The Across the Great Divide event is tomorrow night, Friday the 19th. I'm going down to the Ace Hotel. I'm hosting the thing. I got to get that together, the hosting, what kind of funnies do I want to make. Then I got to bring up all the acts, including Bob Weir, Lucinda Williams, John Prine, Jimmy Vivino's the musical director. He's cajoled me, talked me into playing a song that I played with him before, but Slash is going to be sitting in on that song as well. I discussed this with you before. I'm going full throttle. I practiced a bit. I know I got this problem with my arm and my fingers, my other hand, my picking hand. The nail is seems to be not falling off. I can hold a prick. Woof. Let's not assess that too deeply. I can hold a pick pretty well. I got the strength back in it, so I'm going to go in, I'm going to do it. But boy, did I have I just was waffling confidence-wise all day yesterday. You know when you get that slight sinking feeling, you know, a slight heaviness in the heart, maybe your stomach feels a little pulled upon, a mild kind of tinge of the depression that just makes you feel like you're not good enough to do anything. Yeah, I had that for a few hours, and then I just leaned into the guitar, and I'm just sort of like, get it out, man. Worked on my stand-up a bit. Yeah, I have a bit of, that's where it came from. You know, like, I can't just admit that, like, hey, man, I'm a little nervous about this shit coming up. I'm a little scared. You know, I got to play guitar with Slash. I got to host a big event with some big musical acts, which, you know, should be fun, but I'm just sort of like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? And then I'm going to New York to shoot the Joker movie with De Niro and Joaquin with that scene. And I'm like, oh, my God, that should be. But I'm excited about it. But I have to assume that somewhere under the excitement and the actual feeling of groundedness around this stuff, there exists the ever flowing wellspring of fear and insecurity that I keep underground. It's a subterranean well. I put some concrete over the hole that it used to flow through into my being. But every once in a while, you know, there'll be a little fissure. There'll be a fissure, and then it starts seeping out. The fluid, you know, you can't do this. You're not going to pull it off. Don't pretend like you can handle this. You suck. Just a little, just kind of oozing out of this fissure. I'm excited, is what I'm trying to say. I can't wait to do the stuff I have ahead of me. You know, things are tough in the world. My world is okay. I got some opportunities. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun, right? I don't know, man. It's like, you know, you're gonna pull it off, or like, I don't know. God damn it. Don't talk to me like that. Today on the show, I talked to character actor Richard E. Grant. You know him from a lot of things. Famously, Whitnail and I, and those were the early movies. How to Get Ahead in Advertising, but he was in, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula. He's been The Player. He's been in a lot of stuff. But he's here to talk about this movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me, with Melissa McCarthy, which I thought was very good. Melissa's doing a serious role. It's based on a true story about forgery and desperation. And I enjoyed it. But I was fascinated to talk to Richard E. Grant because he's one of these guys that he's always very intense and slightly morally dubious in movies, and he's got quite a presence. So you know, I didn't know what kind of person he was. Right? You know, is he going to, you know, just tumble in here like Richard Burton after a bender? No, quite the opposite. Great talk, though. Enjoy talking to him. Brian Posehn is here as well for our last shorty, as I call him. Brian Posehn doesn't know it, but he's the last of the short form interviews that we do occasionally here. What can I tell you about Brian Posehn? I've known him since he was a youngster, it seems. We started out sort of together years ago. I remember him when he started. He's got this memoir coming out, Forever Nerdy, My Dorky Dreams and Staying Metal. That comes out next week, actually, October 23rd. You can pre-order it right now. And we had this talk over the summer when we were still doing these shorter interviews, and we held it until we were closer to the book coming out. And it was fun, and it was good. Brian's an evolving guy. I've known him a long time, so it was a great little reconnect. So this is me and Brian Posehn. How you feeling? So your wife told you to get rid of all the things on the phone?
Well, yeah, because it was driving me crazy. And
like it was affecting your life? You couldn't get out of the phone?
I'd just wake up angry and sad, and that would be the first thing I'd go to. And then
to reinforce
whatever I read, would set me off in that direction. And if it was a positive thing, then I would like lay all my, oh, that's going to happen. Now he's out of here. He's gone. Yeah.
And no, it doesn't
fucking
happen.
Nothing.
Right.
And then I'd get mad. But I started off the election just kind of not believing that it was even happening.
Right,
sure. The night that it happened.
Yeah.
Once it started to turn around and go the other way, I went to bed. I went to bed around 10 o'clock.
Right.
And I was just pissed off. And my poor kid could sense my energy.
Yeah.
Because I can't really hide things.
How old
was
he then?
He was 7 then.
Yeah.
And he drew a picture of Trump, like the bird shitting on him, and to try to make me happy.
Yeah.
But it was already over for me. I was just like, I can't believe this is.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go try to sleep.
Right.
And then the last 2 years have just been, writing the book. But then, and I talk about at the end of the book how hard it was to write while I was that pissed off and that worried and that sad and, just going highs and lows.
Right.
And writing about, my life.
Yeah, with
trying
the
to
highs
reflect
and lows
on these things while I'm, also self-medicating with whiskey and weed and,
yeah.
Trying not to kill my family and,
Wait, you're back on the weed and whiskey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It works.
Well, it took the edge off, huh?
Right.
And so everything was falling apart, and then you had to go back into the childhood. But the book is called Forever Nerdy, Living My Dorky Dreams and Staying Metal.
Yeah.
Like, I find that when I write, I hate it primarily.
Uh-huh.
And that, like, when the last book I did on my own, like, it was a real chore, and it's time-consuming, and it hangs over you, and, even if I'm writing about myself, it's sort of like, oh, but I still got to write it.
Yeah.
But there are those moments where you go on these runs where there's a sense of discovery, and you frame, all of a sudden you see things that you in a way that you didn't see them before.
Right.
Did you have that experience?
There were a couple of things. There were a couple of things of stuff where, and I even talk about it in the book, where I'm like, oh, my mom was a virgin when she met my dad? That's weird. Ew. Like I kind of put things together. But I'd never thought,
as a grown-up.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Because, there's still so much of your mind is because of your parents is locked in child mind.
Right.
And you refuse to see
and
them.
I was just kind of going through the whole thing, and I'm like, oh, I don't think she, And then the mom's boyfriend after that, and I was like, oh, she's really only had these three guys. What? Stop thinking about that.
You had to reel it in.
That was one of the things.
You're seeing your mom too much as a person?
Yeah, and I was also, I felt bad for her because I don't have a dad, so pretty much everything in the book is kind of blamed on her.
Right.
And then she moved down here last November, so I was finishing this up, and I'm forced to be around her all the time when I'm writing about her.
Right.
And I felt like guilty, but like there's so much of that shit already in the book. Of,
yeah. Did you put that in there that you're feeling that she came
down?
That
was already in there. No. I barely talk about that.
Yeah.
I mentioned, but.
Well, what did you.
But it made it harder because I'd see her.
Right.
And I'd just written about something about how pissed off I was about this shitty thing she said 30 years ago or whatever that still is stuck in my brain.
Like what?
Oh, just, stuff about the dad kind of, when I would say to her, or when I was a teen, you know, and I thought maybe the situation would have been better if my dad had lived. She'd say stuff like, you know, he wasn't that into the idea of you. You know, when you were born, he wasn't pro Brian, and he's not that great of a dude. And just like, she would just throw him under the bus, and it just made me hate her too.
But
you know?
It's weird though. In her twisted mind, she was probably trying to help, like to sort of like, you know. How did he die again?
He died of a rare blood disease.
Right.
And negligence at the hospital, and my mom didn't do anything about it. But did she know?
You haven't resolved this stuff. You're supposed to maybe process this stuff with the.
I didn't think we were going to get this deep this quick.
But I mean, what? You forgot who you were talking to?
We were just on your porch. You tricked
on the porch,
me into this.
Yeah.
We were just, you were
showing you
greeting
my plants.
Me with a cigar. We were looking at shit. And then now,
boom.
Mom.
Yeah. Well, no, but like, it is a memoir. And I have experience with that. And I also have experience with alienating a parent because of what I wrote.
Oh, she's going to flip.
Yeah. But
I turn it around because our relationship is mostly positive now. So she was super supportive of comedy.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing. And I make a big point of that in the book of going, look, the high school years were rough.
Right.
But once I found this thing that I loved, she realized that, you know, even though she didn't think it was awesome, she didn't laugh at what I was doing.
But
she thought, you know, saw that I loved it and saw that I had some sort of skill with it, you know.
And also that you were probably out among people.
Right.
Yeah, not down in the basement with a bunch of nerds playing a game.
Right.
Like, he seems to be out in the world.
Yes.
And that must have been thank God.
Oh, for sure.
So you go all the way back, you know, you do the whole thing.
I wasn't going to when I was going to write when I started.
Why'd you
I
do
had
it?
The
what
idea,
was the, what, did you? It was your idea, or did somebody say like, why don't you write a book?
I'd written some blurbs for some friends of ours. I didn't do it. Wasn't Stanhope, but it was the same editor that's worked with Stanhope.
Uh-huh.
And I'd done a blurb for Rex Brown's book. He's the bass player for Pantera, and then I'd done one for one of Scott Ian's.
And nice guy.
So that editor said, hey, man, if you have a book in you, we'd love to hear it, because he liked what I had written just in the blurbs.
Oh,
he's
right.
Like, you clearly can write.
You got to break through blurbs.
Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah.
And then instead of going through my agency and having them shop it, when I came up with the concept, I just went to this guy. I said, look, you know, you've done metal and comedy.
Yeah.
And this is, you know.
That's me.
That's me. So do you want to hear it? He loved it. And then we just went. It's through DiCapo, and it was easy. Instead of getting my agent got involved then.
Yeah.
Once I had sold it on my own.
Right. Oh, that's great.
But,
that's what they
do. That was kind of the way I wanted to do it, though.
But I didn't mind. Right.
I didn't mind because I didn't want to go through the other process of them trying to take me around to all these
bidding
places.
Bidding wars and that kind of thing.
Well, there wouldn't have been. In my head, everybody was going to go, nah, we're good.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go through that, that kick in the nuts.
So
I'd rather go to somebody who, you know.
Was into it.
Was into it.
And they just came in to negotiate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's, and then take their 10.
Right.
We're here. So you got everything done? Great.
Right.
We'll put the paperwork together.
Right. Which is fine.
Yeah. No, that's what they do.
That's what I wanted.
Yeah. No, I'm not criticizing them. That's the way the business is structured because we don't know how to handle money.
No. So it originally started as kind of, I was just going to do essays. No, I was going to do essays about my life.
That's what I did. Yeah. The last one.
But then I just, when I started writing about the first 10 years, because I talk about nerdiness, but I also, and I've talked about it in my act, how I think, you know, you're not born a nerd.
Right.
You find it, you know, you might be born with like OCD.
Right.
Which, you know,
leads
plays
to
into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, you know, it started at 10 years old, but then I talk about those first 10 years and I talk about, you know, the darkness,
sure.
And the death and that kind of stuff.
And what was your original obsession to start defining the
nerd?
The
first one I say in the book is Jaws, and then the first bit after that was Star Wars, and
right.
that like
that was it.
Jaws was paled by how massively I got into Star Wars and how obsessed I got. And then Kiss was right around the same time. It was Kiss and Star Wars were my first two things.
That's a pretty good trifecta. Jaws to start. You know, and then boom, the machine,
and
the
all
shark.
Within 76, 77, within like 2 years that, you know, I was.
And you're able to track it to like, you know, handling grief and the sadness and the isolation of the dad thing and of being awkward in general. It's mm-hmm. almost like a nerdism is almost like it can be like a religion.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, you find these things that, you know, define you and are massive,
right.
and you can sort of turn your life over to them.
Well, I even say, yeah, I say in the book that to me, nerdiness is just about obsession, and I even think religion is, they're just Jesus nerds.
No,
and their cosplaying is
a little
point.
More dangerous.
yeah,
general. The cultural implications of Christian cosplay could end the world.
Right.
yeah. No, I think that's true. I thought that about... you know, just ritualistic religions like, you know, Orthodox Jews, you know, Muslims, Catholics, that, you know, there's that the idea of all these arcane rituals is an OCD. It's an organized mm-hmm. method to sort of keep you connected to this thing and you have to do it.
Right. And it's funny. I was Christian until I kind of around. It's not like I left Christianity and went, now I'm into Star Wars instead.
Yeah.
But it kind of happened around the same time.
Well, yeah. But
and where I got more into metal and I got, you know, when people were shitting on Kiss and stuff, I was like, Kiss is not Knights in Satan's Service. It's.
Yeah. Right. Oh, right.
It's
oh, when
two Jewish guys and an Italian dude and another guy, Fraley is.
In clown makeup.
yeah. Yeah.
no, but I think that's true because, like, for kids, certainly, and I think it happens now too with gaming and stuff, it's like it's present, it's accessible, it's engaged, and it's now.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not like some sort of hypothetical. It's like I see Luke Skywalker. you know, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's where it started, and then like you kind of move through the life.
Yeah, and then comedy, finding, you know, it's about all the different obsessions. I touch on.
Were you a D&D
comedy.
Guy too?
I wasn't at first, and I talk about that. So in junior high, I heard about it, and I was like, oh, this seems like something I would love.
Yeah.
But there was already a kid that I hated at Sunday school.
yeah, yeah.
He was like the Christian bully, which is so weird. Like he would fuck with me.
Yeah.
It kind of was, because he was the one guy that was like that. I felt like at Christian camp and at Sunday school and at church group and all those places, I felt pretty safe.
Yeah.
Except for this one dude.
Yeah.
And then I showed up at D&D and he sees me. I walk into the room, you know, it's D&D club in seventh grade.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this is going to be my place. I open the door. He sees me and goes, Posehn, what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh, man, I can't even be into this. And then I just went to the library, and I talk about that in the book. I worked in the library in junior high and high school.
And that guy is now a congressman.
Probably. He's a Facebook friend, and I try to.
Oh, is he?
He asked me. Yeah,
So you guys all right?
I've changed his name in the book.
Oh, no, good. No. You got it.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you have to. Yeah. So you don't get in trouble, and you can just write about it.
Right.
But so that guy was sort of the bane of your existence?
At church camp, at Sunday school, there was plenty of dicks at high school and junior high. But
yeah.
Then, yeah.
And isn't that like sort of the thrust of the story is that, you know, how you, you know, were isolated because of things that were sort of out of your control,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you had to sort of cloister with the other freaks.
Right.
And then like, you know, at some point, you know, because there was a shift in culture, you were able to own it.
Yeah. Well, I talk about that definitely.
Yeah. I mean, because
how I'm not bitter about it either. There's a ton of bitter nerds that are like, hey, I didn't have there weren't hot girls wearing the I Heart Nerds shirt. And I'm it is what it is. And it worked out for me. I'm not mad about the girls that didn't fuck me still.
You're just mad about your mom.
yeah.
you know, you go to the source.
For making me unfuckable. It's her fault.
Yeah, that one is all her fault.
yeah,
That's all her fault. Yeah. So, I mean, but I remember, like, and we talked about this the first time we talked. I mean, there was, I remember the shift. Like, it's weird because when I see guys do it now, I think they're kind of late. I don't want to mention anyone's name, but I remember, like, you shifting from long hair, metal dude to, like, guy wearing glasses, you know, with the good haircut and beard thing. Like, it was a very distinct shift.
Right.
Right, you know what I mean? Like, it's,
well,
like,
it didn't happen. It wasn't like I went, I'm going to be this guy.
No, I know.
The hair was the girlfriend at the time and her friend. What do you call it when people gang up on you? An intervention. They showed up and said, you're cutting your hair today, and we're taking you to a different clothing store. And you're going to turn this shit around.
Because all you wore were t-shirts and a hat sometimes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I looked like I still worked at a skateboard shop, which was my last day job. Well, record store was my last day job. But my last 2 day jobs were, you know, skateboards and record stores. So.
But it was right around like the Mr. Showtime.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're sort of like, oh, that's, look at Brian. He's all cleaned up.
And it was also like, David Cross looks good with a bald head. I should just do what he's doing. I think maybe I co-opted the beard from Louis or maybe. I feel like there were other guys that were doing the bald head beard thing.
Yeah.
Or at least, because I experimented with goatees. And I used to have the Pearl Jam thing for back when I knew you.
Yeah.
When I had long hair, but then I had just the, just the Flavor Saver.
Oh, no mustache.
And I grew it, nothing. It, just the Flavor Saver. And I grew it long. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah,
like I
weird
thought
long?
I was a Stone Gossard.
Yeah, right. You have that. You have to be defined by something.
But then talking about nerdiness came from also me wanting to be less brick road or brick, not brick road, but brick wall.
Yeah.
Which is what I had kind of been lumped in. Like I was finding in the alternative scene in L.A., where I would show up at some of those shows and they'd go, no, you know, you're an improv guy.
You're a mainstream comic.
Yeah. I won't name some people, but there's people that ran some of those rooms that were like, nah.
Really?
Patton fits. This other guy fits, but you don't fit.
But we all started.
And so then
we all started in.
Most of us were brick wall comics.
Of course.
Before we found that, you know.
That was because that was all there was then.
Yeah, and Patton had a suit in his first, you know.
Oh, yeah.
His first 8x10. You know, we did all those things.
That alley shot.
No, but you know what I mean? We did those things. We had business cards and 8x10s. Like,
because we.
All the comics in the 80s did.
And right, because we came in a little earlier. Yeah. Like, we were all, like, probably, you know, middles or headliners by the time alt comedy started.
Right.
But you've been writing for a long time. I remember because, like, I was a bitter cunt then. You know, like, when I saw Mr. Show, I'm like, what the fuck, you know? What are all these guys who just get the TV show? And you're on there. I'm like, Posehn's on there? How is this happening?
I got that gig, I think, because Bob loved that I didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like, Bob and I met one time. He knew who I was, and I knew who he was through David. I knew David first. Cross was coming up to San Francisco a lot before I moved down here. And so when I moved down here, they'd already done Stiller and that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so they were, like, looking for the next thing, and they were starting to write sketches together, and they were friends. And then I met at that old Virgin Megastore.
Yeah.
And I was wearing a Sub Pop jacket that said Loser on it. And I just moved here. I was living with Dave Rath and was working at MTV.
I remember that house.
And I see Odenkirk, and Odenkirk sees me. And I should have been like, hey, man, how are you doing? He's like, he comes up to me. He goes, you're Brian Posehn, right? And I go, yeah. And I'm just kind of a dick.
Yeah.
And then he walked away from that going across like, hey, is there something wrong with that guy? Cross was like, he's funny enough.
Yeah.
And then I think Bob was like, eh, maybe we're kind of the same guy because we can't really talk to people or want to.
Right. So, and that's how it happened?
Pretty much. And then, you know, they said, hey, do you want to write some sketches for this thing? And
it was great.
And they had already put me in sketches by that point.
Right.
Because I fit like a type. They had like a grunge thing they wanted. So,
yeah.
You know, I already had the Sub Pop thing, and they had to, you know, put a hat on me, and there we go.
But I mean, part of the book is sort of like, you know, hanging on to the parts of that you still love and define you.
Right.
And yet still, you know, you don't have a choice.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know, like even if you wanted to shift, there are just some things there's no way that you could let go. Right.
My therapist seems to think that I could let go of that.
But then you have to, as a grown person,
right.
You make these decisions where you're like, yeah, I don't, why are we trying to get rid of that?
No, that was a, you know, and I've made money off being the nerd or being the picked on guy. So, you know, but there was a point 10 years ago in therapy where my therapist was like, you should let go of that. You're not that guy anymore. And I'm like, I'm kind of making money doing it.
But do you think you are not that guy anymore? I guess you're not being picked on.
Well, I'm not. No, I'm not, because I'm also, you know, I'm a little kid's favorite person in the world.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so there are things where this 9-year-old thinks I'm the coolest guy ever and the funniest guy ever. And so there is confidence that comes with that. And, you know,
and that's a service.
And having fans and
sure.
And knowing that, you know, I did connect with some people. And you know,
but how does that evolve, though? Like,
it makes you feel a little better about, you know.
Sure. Well, you're a functioning adult.
Right.
And, you know, and you know what your limitations and what your talents are.
Right.
But in writing the book, like, do you find that, like, okay, so you don't have to overplay it anymore, but you're still sitting around listening to metal,
right?
And, you know, I'm sure you're like, I don't know what your game intake is or what you're telling your kids good and bad, you know, but I imagine a lot of that stuff is the same stuff.
Oh, what I'm turning him onto?
Yeah. I mean, just sort of like, you know, and in terms of, you know, how you guys interact.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't have anything to go off of with the dad thing. So I just tried to be cool and just tried to be there for him and also, you know, be his friend. And when I get to the phase, you know, we're not at the phase yet where I'm going to have to be more stern or,
right.
you know, because he's a good little guy now.
He's 9?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's
and
he
I keep
into?
Waiting for, you know, 15.
The turn?
Yeah, the turn. Like, I like Sublime, Dad. You're a dick. Because that's going to be the one. Like, Trump and Sublime would be the way to,
I think that, like, you got a good chance it might not happen. Is anyone going to give a fuck about Sublime by the time he's 14?
Right.
I mean, it'll be somebody else.
But that's the way to rebel in my house.
So, what was the big takeaway from the book? Like, you know, when you were done writing it, outside of, like, that's a fucking relief. You know, did anything sort of like come together for you?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in there that, cause you had asked me on the porch about, you know, when we were talking about, if the book's going to be out before the end of the world and, you know, it reaching some nerd. I think some of the things that I say about bullying and my situation with that and then also kind of embracing the nerdiness.
Yeah.
Might ring true for some people.
I think it does have a big impact.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's why, ultimately, like, that was the sort of...
That's what I hope.
Yeah. I mean,
But I also wanted it to be funny and have dumb things that people can, you know, picture coming out of my... And I'm going to do a audio book, too. So,
oh, yeah, it's
but
great.
But I felt like as I was writing it, I was like, oh, this definitely feels like it's in my voice. And I kept getting that back from the editor.
Oh,
and
that's great.
That was the main thing, was like... Have it be readable, have it be funny, have it be in my voice, and
honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because like that's the weird thing with the way this stuff works, even like the podcast and stuff, is that, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are isolated, that don't talk to people much, that don't, like, that have similar issues that we do, and when they just, like, if they can just hear someone else talking about it, it's like, it makes so much difference. To know that you're not fucking alone in the world.
Right.
I never really understood it, you know, because part of me just kind of likes being alone in the world, you know?
Right. Well, and there was a point where people would go, hey, if you can get a pretty girl, then I can. And I was like, well, fuck you. And then I'm like, oh, wait, no. Yeah, you're right. That is cool.
Sure.
That I proved to you that...
that you could get a pretty
girl. But also
girl.
Fuck you.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, man.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's great seeing you. It's always great seeing you. Seriously. He's the real deal, folks. Brian Posehn, the memoir Forever Nerdy, My Dorky Dreams and Staying Metal, comes out next week, October 23rd. It'll be funny. And those of you who relate to that stuff, it's about you. You can pre-order it right now. I remember what I wanted to tell you about. I had a humbling experience. But last night I decided to go to a party I was invited to. I didn't really know why I was invited. It was a charity event, kind of. It was at a home. It was an evite from Kathleen Hanna and Adam Horovitz. Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill and Adam from the Beastie Boys. I've never met either of them. But I figured, well, they must want to meet me. They must want to have me over. They must. That's exciting because I'd like to talk to both of them, and it would be fun to meet them. And I'm glad that my reputation precedes me. And so it was an event at their home for an organization called Peace Sisters. PeaceSisters.org. It's about raising money to pay for the education of girls in Togo in Africa. But, so I made a donation through the Evite, and, I was pretty sure I'd see people I knew there, but I was thrilled that that they knew who I was and that they're having me at their house. So, we get there and we walk in, and, Kathleen comes to the door, and I say, hi, Mark Maron, and didn't seem to register that much. And I said, I just talked to Joan Jett. She had nice things to say about you. And she's like, oh, yeah, you talked to Joan? I'm like, yeah, I did on my podcast. She's like, oh, you have a podcast? I'm like, yeah, I do. She goes, yeah, I'm just starting to get into podcasts. And part of the event was that she's making T-shirts of people, having artists do T-shirts to sell with all the proceeds going to the charities. So there's a small T-shirt shop in the house there, and she was wearing a Hari Kondabolu shirt, which is an esoteric shirt, but many of you may know Hari. He's a comic, and I saw a W. Kamau Bell shirt, and I'm like, oh, I know Hari, and yeah, I see Kamau, I know them. They're comics. I'm a comic. She's like, oh, you do comedy too? And I'm like, yeah, I do comedy. I have a podcast. And then I realized that she didn't know me at all. No idea who I was or what I did. And that, after a certain point in this game, you think you reach a certain level, certainly with a certain type of person that, you'd be known. Nope. And Adam Horowitz, the same thing, did not really seem to know who I was. So I'm like, why am I at their house? Why? How did this happen? But I saw Fred Armisen there, and Carrie Brownstein, and Jackie Tone was there, and I saw some of the guys from SNL, Paul Russ. So I saw a lot of people I knew, and Sarah, the painter, saw a lot of painters that she knew there. It was a nice event, and I learned about this cause, and it was very moving. The woman who started it was there, and Kathleen is involved in it. But there was sort of that, all the way through, that kind of weird kind of like nag of like, why was I invited? These people don't even know me. And then I ran into the publicist who handles They Might Be Giants, and apparently she recommended that I come. And I'm glad that I had that moment, because I wouldn't have known why. And I do admit that I was a little humbled by the whole thing. Is that wrong? I mean, if you were invited to a party, and you weren't sure, you never met the people that were having the party, but you were invited, and then you got there and they didn't know you, wouldn't you be like, oh, that kind of stings a little? Well, it did. All right? But it was nice to meet everybody, and hopefully I get to talk to the Beastie Boys and maybe Kathleen at some point. But right now, let's talk about Richard E. Grant. Now, you know this guy. If it's not ringing a bell, you know him. If you haven't seen the classics, Whitnail and I, or How to Get Ahead in Advertising. I mean, he's been in a lot of stuff. L.A. Story, The Player, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Age of Innocence. He was in, Gosford Park. That was a big movie. He was great in that. He's just one of those guys you see around, and you're like, oh, that guy. It's that guy. But apparently he was in Logan, too, which I didn't see. And he's in the upcoming Star Wars, from what I understand. That's what he told me. But anyways, his new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me, with Melissa McCarthy, it opens in select theaters tomorrow, October 19th. And it's good. It's good. This is me talking to Richard E. Grant. Old houses are nice. Do you have an old house?
1870.
See, that's the thing. Where are you live, London?
Yeah.
London's got a lot more older stuff.
Yeah. It does.
We're very excited here when something's lasted 100 years.
Exactly.
There you can live in a place that's 400, 500, 600 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know. We can't even make it through 200 years in this country.
Why?
I don't know. It's going downhill, Richard. How are things in England?
Oh, they're exactly the same. It's a shit show wherever you go. And I was reading Roman diaries from ancient Rome.
Oh, good.
And, you know, Plautus and all those guys, they were just saying it's, you know, it's the end of the world. It's all, everything's gone down the pan.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's just, you know, it's the nature of stuff. And, you know, I speak to people who lived through the Second World War and they say, you know, compared to what they went through,
right,
you know, this is, we're living jam and honey.
Yeah.
Milk and honey.
It's right. When I've talked to the few people that I've talked to from the UK, you know, the older guys,
yeah,
you know, McKellen and Patrick Stewart and people, they're like, I remember bombs.
Yeah.
You know, they were, you know, we were in tunnels.
Exactly.
And
so the fact that we don't have them now, you think, well, you know, that's an improvement.
I guess so. But it's the very proficient and focused psychological warfare that's damning right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just turn on any device and you're going to just shatter your brain's ability to function properly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you stay away from them?
I plunge into every single possible thing that I can. I'm in information overload.
Are you all the time?
You know, that, I don't know whether you do this, but if you Wikipedia somebody or you Google them beforehand, and then, of course, you think you know everything, and then, of course, you meet the person face-to-face, and all that stuff just goes out the window, and you go, oh, there's a human being that I'm talking to, and you look them in the eye. But you go on the subway or the tube or whatever, whatever the train system it is, and the silhouette of our age seems to be everybody is, their head is, even when they're crossing, pedestrian crossing, glued to the, you know.
Yeah, they're getting hit by cars.
That's cell phone.
It's my biggest fear of walking down the sidewalk or crossing a street is some asshole is going to be looking at his phone like I do.
But we sound like these grumpy old guys, you know, Waldorf and Statler.
I know.
Right,
but well, we're also old guys that have adapted. You know, my dad, I don't think has ever listened to one of my podcasts because he claims he can't make the jump to, you know, push an arrow on his screen.
And how does that make you feel?
Well, that's a long story. I've covered it fairly thoroughly.
You're very angry.
No. It is what it is. He is what he is. And, you know, whatever damage he did, I've transcended some of it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yes. But, you know, what you've done is remarkable that you're here in your garage.
Yes.
And you've done it. So you've brought the world to you.
I have. It was sort of a bit of cosmic timing that finally worked out.
Yeah.
And just being, having some sort of talent for it, that I didn't know. It was all born out of desperation, Richard.
As everything is, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But the Google thing or the Wikipedia thing you say is true because I do that often.
Yeah.
I always do find that there's a person over there. Like I see you as a person. My assumptions about you after doing a bit of research, I don't like to do too much. But a lot of times, two things. Wikipedia can be way wrong.
Yeah.
Like there's just made up people in it.
Yes.
There's made up pasts. And I learned early on that to make, if I start leading a guest into sort of like, so your dad was the army, huh? That's right. And they're like, no.
I'm like, he was a ballet dancer.
Exactly. But the human thing is all, because I assumed, like, having watched your work for years, that, you know, that you would come like tumbling in here like Richard Burton, you know, up all night with a cigarette just reeking of alcohol.
I'll go out and so that I can fulfill this fantasy of yours.
No, but I don't know why I would think that. But, you know, I mean, some of the characters are a little gnarly, but you're clean, you're showered.
Yep.
You're
allergic to alcohol. All of that helps.
That must have been a rough thing to find out. Were you told that or was it an experience?
Oh, no, I couldn't keep anything down. And when I was 16, I went to the doctor and said, you know, I'm socially embarrassed because I can't hold alcohol.
Yeah.
And in a macho culture that I grew up in this tiny country, this smallest country in the Southern Hemisphere, Swaziland, that was, you know, you were persona non grata. You needed a drink.
Yeah.
And he did a blood test and he said to me, you know, do you have Asian blood? And I said, not that I know of. Why are you asking that? He said, because you have no enzyme to process alcohol whatsoever. You can never, ever drink. It's completely toxic to you. So
you lucked out. You avoided the alcoholism trap.
Yeah. He said, order a ginger ale and people will leave you alone. And I've done that ever since.
Yeah. Yeah. No smoking either?
No.
Really?
I tried one, 1970.
Oh my God. You're like completely not the guy that I've seen in movies.
Yeah, but I like dope.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you can smoke dope.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. Swaziland, like I had to research that. I had to, because I was sort of like, what am I going to talk to him about?
It's like the size of Glendale.
Is it really? Yeah. It's that small?
Yeah, it's tiny.
What years were you there? You were born there?
I was born there because my father was the Minister of Education while it was still an English protectorate under the last gasp of the British Empire. And then they regained their independence in 1968.
Uh-huh.
And we carried on living there, and I went to school there because of my father's job.
So he still had the job even after the... how does that work? So he worked for... is there an empire? He worked for the empire, and then the empire was pulling back?
Yeah, he worked for the British government. And then after independence, he was kept on as an honorary advisor because he was fluent in Siswati. So he stayed on, and then he died there at the age of 51.
So they kept him there sort of like, just, you know, we're not in power, but keep an eye on things.
He's a token white guy.
Let us know what they're up to.
Action. Exactly.
And so what was the culture like? So how did that define you? Do you have siblings?
I do, but I haven't seen him since my father's funeral 100 years ago.
You haven't seen your siblings since your father's funeral?
What it essentially was a hermetically sealed... more English than English colonial bubble that I grew up in.
So you didn't go beyond the fence?
Not really. And it was characterized by the three B's, booze, boredom, and bonking.
Bonking.
Yeah.
I think that word's no longer in operation.
It's no longer. Okay. It's gone. It defines how old I am.
Did that evolve into shagging?
Yes, shagging, bonking.
Bonking.
Stupping.
Yeah.
Whatever you call it.
Go Yiddish.
Mating.
Yeah, I think some of the youngsters call it just hanging out now.
Hanging out.
Yeah, do you want to hang out?
Yeah.
But all right, so you didn't experience the tension of apartheid. Was your father, you know, do you come from Dutch people?
I come from very liberal, white, Caucasian, highly educated people. And Swaziland was essentially, it was nicknamed the Switzerland of Africa because it was mountainous and it was between Marxist Mozambique on the one side and fascist apartheid South Africa on the other. So they tread this neutral line. So all the South African political dissidents sent from the ANC sent their kids to school in Swaziland. So I went to school and did school plays with Nelson Mandela's daughters and stuff. So that gives you an idea that I had a very liberal, you know, essentially white middle class education.
Well, that's a gift, I think.
I think so, yeah. It sets you up for tolerance in the world and hope and idealism.
Oh, those two, the last two are trouble, but...
they've been beaten out of me by real life.
Tolerance is something that I think that is actually one of the interesting things about the possible crumbling of liberal democracy is that was the hinge that a lot of people just couldn't handle, that it's necessary for democracy to work that you have to have tolerance, and it's not necessarily, you're not born with it.
No.
You have to engage it.
You have to learn it.
Yes.
And like now, good manners.
Right. And now that all these shameless tyrants and weirdos are taking over, people are like, you mean we don't have to put up with this shit anymore?
Yes.
And they couldn't be happier.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a fucking nightmare. But let's get back to you.
Okay.
So you're in Switzerland of Africa.
Yeah. What about you? Where were you?
When I was younger, when it all went down? Well, when Kennedy was shot, I was 2 months old. I grew up in New Mexico, born in New Jersey. Most of the formative years, though, second grade through high school in New Mexico.
That was you, Frank Sinatra, Meryl Streep, and Bruce Willis.
About what, Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I there's more. Springsteen. I mean, the list goes on. Jersey produced a lot of people. I do feel genetically attached, but I am not. I was more New Mexico. And then I was in Boston, L.A., New York. I got around chasing the comedy.
So where do you feel that you belong? Where's your identity?
The where my brain goes when it seeks comfort.
Yeah.
Probably New Mexico, I would think.
Albuquerque.
Yeah. Well, or just, you know, northern New Mexico in general, the feel of the air and the kind of, it's weird that, you know, the skies there's something about, the thing that draws me back there is not my high school buddies or that my parents were so terrific.
The geography.
How about you?
The smell of it. Yeah, it's the exact same thing. But
Swaziland?
Yeah. But do you find that Breaking Bad has given Albuquerque a bad or a good reputation? Was that your experience of it?
Well, anything that can bring money into that city, I think, is good. And if people want to take little tours to the doghouse where the hot dogs were and here and there, I think it seems fine. I think that the studios that were built out there, and I guess the tax incentives that people get for shooting, helps the economy. I mean, I don't know that Breaking Bad it's a fictitious story, but I do think that the economy of New Mexico has its problems, and they do have, I believe, a methamphetamine issue.
Right. But what you're talking about is that landscape has this real homing pigeon instinct in you.
I think it
goes beyond your friends, your parents, whatever. You just, you're drawn back to that.
Well, it is something like if the landscape, because I remember New Jersey too, but what I remember about it is sort of humidity, green, tomatoes, like my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're forming and you're in high school and there's some sort of, you know, whatever struggles you're going through as a conscious person, you know, if you find some, you know, if you find some sort of reprieve in the environment, and New Mexico is very beautiful, you know, it kind of, it sits in the back of your head as like, I constantly think about moving back there.
And has this increased as you've got into your later second half of your 50s?
I just hit the middle 50s. Right. I just hit 55.
Right.
It's increased since I've had the freedom to make choices about my life. You know, before I earned a living, which was, you know, up to 45 years old, there was a bit of panic. But now I'm sort of like, wouldn't it be nice to just stop?
Now you're living in the mansion in Glendale. You're living the dream.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just like, I don't have a wife. I don't have kids. I don't have much debt. So I'm like, what am I saving money for?
Why have you had so many wives?
Two wives?
Yeah.
You did do your homework.
Yeah.
I just had two. Is that so many?
I mean, well, that's quite a lot. And because they weren't long-lived ones. I mean, they weren't so long ones.
No.
Long marriages.
The first one, I think, was something I did out of an attempt at normalizing.
Yeah.
And the second one,
I feel abnormal.
Well, I just feel like, you know, when you live the life of an entertainer, an actor, I would assume as well, where your security is, you know, dubious.
Yes.
That, you know, and also I was a drinker and, you know, a little out of control. And, I met a woman who was familiar to me in you know, the social structure, you know, and I thought like, well, that'll shape me up.
Right.
Didn't. And then I fell in love with some other woman and I got sober, and I was a crazy person sober, and I eventually drained her of her life force and she went away.
And who is currently re-energizing your life force?
Well, I think I found a fairly non-dramatic, sort of a stable, grounded woman who's a painter, abstract painter.
So does that mean that you were addicted to people that created drama around you before?
Well, I don't know. Like, I think that if you do the research, that, you're going to, you know, whether you don't know so immediately, you're going to, the people you're most connected with are going to be what you come from. Have you found that?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't come from drama. You didn't come from insanity?
Oh, yeah, high drama. You know, alcoholic father, drank himself to death, basically unrequited love for my mother. And he tried to shoot me when I was 15because I emptied a crate of his scotch down the sink.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, all that stuff. But it's...
But they were divorced?
They were divorced. And I didn't realize that he was still in love with her. He told me on his deathbed that he'd never stopped loving her. And so in that moment, I understood the tragedy of his life.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's weird with the finite nature of it.
Yeah.
That you know, it's not that long of a run. And if you don't make some minor fixes, you're going to... Yeah. Like, what about your mom?
Oh, she's 87 and firing on all cylinders.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And she's a chipper?
Yeah, she's very chipper, yeah, because her second husband's not so chipper. But she is on, you know, she has great longevity in her genes and... She reads, you know, 8 books a week, and she's on fire with stuff. So I'm very impressed by her. And I've had a rapprochement with her, which has been good for my mental health.
Yeah.
You know, all these things are important.
So you were holding on to some darkness?
Yeah. 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 I had a nervous breakdown. I was 42.
How old are you now?
I am 62.
So let's go back for a second. So you're a kid in Swaziland.
Yeah.
You've got a sibling that you don't talk about or talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what happened there.
Well, I think he has issues and problems.
Oh.
Sibling rivalry. You know,
he
perceives me as the favorite child, and that's the narrative that he has in his head that I can't dislodge.
And it's an aggressive narrative.
It has been, yeah. Yeah.
So these are just boundaries that you're...
Just boundaries.
Yeah.
That you finally have to draw.
Yeah.
For your own safety.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it's a painful thing when you have to do it with family.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know?
Because they believe they have, you know, extraterrestrial rights over you, and, you know, they don't.
No, is he older?
2.5 years younger.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's the same thing. They hang on to it. It's hard to, like, it's like your sad father with the unrequited love.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you lock into something and it feels... You know, deep enough.
Yeah.
No shaking it.
Yeah, exactly.
So your parents, how old were you when they got divorced?
I was 11. And I woke up on the back seat of a car and inadvertently saw my mother shagging my father's best friend on the front seat. So that sort of got me started diary writing, because I couldn't tell anybody. You know,
you knew that it was bad.
I knew that I was seeing something that I shouldn't see. And so, yeah.
And she just thought you were sleeping, and she was going to get away with that?
She thought I was sleeping, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, she didn't have too many choices about where she could do it.
I know, but maybe it says something to her British nature that it would be quiet enough.
Probably.
Stifle it, you know, stifle the noises.
And add to the excitement.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've discussed this and it's all been out in the open now. And it's you know, it's
at 40, thing. At 42.
Yeah. Well, at 44, I finally confronted her about it in a peaceful way, you know, as a result of help from a psychoanalyst. And, you know, she said the three magic words, which I'm sure you will know the power of these, when she said, please forgive me.
Oh, my God.
And that was, you know, the power shift was instantaneous, and my mental health improved incrementally by the nanosecond, which is why I'm this happy, well-adjusted person, you know.
Because you felt it. You like, you know, it was real.
Yeah.
Because she had probably been carrying it somewhere as well.
Absolutely. Can you imagine carrying that, knowing that you have all that stuff to unburden?
It's insane what we carry for a lifetime.
Yeah.
This seems to be the theme.
Are you positive by nature, or
are you kidding?
You're a curmudgeon.
Yeah, I mean,
like Lee Israel.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not that much of a curmudgeon.
Listeners, we're sitting in a dark cave in Glendale, covered in cobwebs and misery.
I'm not as much of a curmudgeon as Lee Israel in the film or in person. And I watched it. I enjoyed it a lot, and we're going to talk about it. But I'm not through with my vetting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this diary business.
Yeah.
So I know you hang on to that, but you still do it?
I still do it because I think because of the country that I grew up in, the circumstance, there was no television, and the huge thrill of my childhood was Neil Armstrong landing on the moon.
On the moon. You know, they're making a movie about that, I think.
Exactly. It's called First Man. And I saw that, I heard that on the wireless, it was then called, in 1969 when I was 12 years old, when you were still in, you know, diapers. And
well, I was six. Maybe I was in diapers. I had problems.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah,
go
problems.
Ahead. Yeah.
And so it seemed as unlikely to say that you wanted to be an actor as it was to say, well, I'm going to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
So to have ended up traveling the world as I have done, meeting the people that I have done, sitting here opposite you. And,
yeah,
you know,
this is a big one.
It's it's a way of making it feel real.
Yeah. The diary is.
Yeah, it is.
I think that's a good thing, because I've never been able to stick with it, you know. But at 11, it was more.
Yeah, but you record everything, so you've got.
I record a lot, but the stuff that goes on behind the face is really the important stuff.
Yeah,
what comes out of the face, you know, that.
So you're the smiling clown. You're Ipeliachi, because you're smiling at me now, but you're actually weeping in misery.
Not misery, but but I could weep pretty easily.
Okay,
could you?
That comes with age. Oh yeah. Since having a child, I don't even watch the news. It makes me weep.
Yeah,
and I mean that genuinely.
No, I the sensitivity thing is kind of profound, but it happens in weird ways. I don't get it from the news, but I can get it from moments on the street that seem painfully human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that again, tolerance and the other that you have to learn, and another thing you have to learn is empathy.
Yeah.
I don't think we're naturally prone to that.
No.
We're selfish monsters.
You know, acts of selflessness or kindness or tenderness and completely undo me, because they're not the norm in my experience of life.
Yeah, and how old were you when you had the child?
Oh, I was, she is 29. I can't do the math. I was 31.
Well, that's all right. Yeah. I mean, so you've had this crying problem for, you know, 25 years?
Oh, 29 years. Yeah, since the day she was born, 1989. Yeah, since then.
So this thing, but it seems like the diary was more of a confessional thing. Like, you know, you needed to sort of account for the darkness you were carrying.
Yeah, I tried religion. I don't know whether you tried that, but, you know, I got no answer.
How old were you when you tried religion?
When I was 11.
Oh, and that was it? That you made one attempt at 11 and you're like,
well, I tried for about 6 months. And
what'd you try?
I tried the Bible and praying and all that.
Come from a church family?
No, and I got no answer. My father said that, you know, heaven and hell is what you make of your own life. It's the here and now. Be reassured that there is nothing beyond that. When you die, you go back to the unbeing of before you're born.
Unbeing. I kind of like that.
And I found that very reassuring.
Yeah.
To have that. So
and now you know in retrospect that your father lived in a hell until his deathbed. Like exactly. He chose hell, and you don't. And you don't
living hell.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So keeping a diary was a way of, you know, I couldn't tell my friends. I certainly couldn't tell my parents.
Yeah.
So it was a way of making it that I didn't go nuts, that I thought, this has happened. It's a recording of what's going on.
It's fucking genius, because as you get older,
yeah.
I can't, like, I met, if you do a diary in the immediacy of it, if you do it every day,
yeah.
I would imagine that you can at least document the moment in your mind and in reality, because as I get older, I don't know what's happened and what hasn't and what yeah. really happened. And yeah. like I've lived in enough cities now, and I'm 55. People walk up to me and they're like, "Hey, man, you remember?" I'm like, "You're gonna have to,
remind
you know,
me.
Yeah, you're gonna have to give me a city,
yeah,
yeah, a time period, because I'm not clicking right now."
No.
So how do you get out of Swaziland? How do you end up an actor? Because I always make assumptions about the British actors, like that you're all hanging around the same lofty, kind of classically trained Shakespearean model.
Well, no, that's not true in my case. My father said, your brain is too good to waste on trying to be an actor. There's no precedent in our family for doing that. So if you can find a university where you can do a theater training at the same time,
yeah.
do that.
Right. So he wanted you to be what?
He wanted me to be a lawyer or a writer or a journalist or you know, something with a noble profession.
Uh-huh.
And he genuinely thought that being an actor was a lifetime of wearing makeup tights and avoiding buggery.
But it's interesting. Those were his concerns, not that like you would possibly not make a living or that it was a scary thing for you.
Yeah, he also thought that I would be destitute.
Yeah, right.
And I said, well, I didn't care about money. And he said, well, you can only say that because you're young, because you will need money. Yeah.
And this is in Swaziland.
This is in Swaziland. So I found there was a local architect who told me that there was a drama training thing in Cape Town, which was 1,200 miles south of where I grew up.
Yeah.
And you could go and do a university degree there and then make an exception according to your academia of doing the theater diploma at the same time over 4 years. So that's what I did.
In Cape Town?
In Cape Town. I co-founded a theater company and then I left there after 2 years and emigrated to England.
Well, what was the theater company?
It was called the Troupe Theater Company and it was multiracial and it was based at a theater called The Space in Cape Town.
The Space in Cape Town. What year is this? What are we talking, like 60?
This is I graduated in 1979, and I worked in a theater company 1980, 1981, and then emigrated.
Okay, so like the world was very connected at that point. You weren't living in, you know, people got information, not as quickly as we do now. So yeah. I'm just trying to figure out the tone. Was it like experimental theater? Were they confronting political?
Everything was anti-apartheid.
Right.
Yeah.
When did apartheid get lifted? It was in the
80s? 1992.
Wow,
Nelson
right.
Mandela was released from prison.
So it was provocative, dangerous theater you were doing.
That's what we were doing. But unfortunately, as you will know all too well, that if you are doing theater for a liberal middle class audience,
mm-hmm.
you're preaching to the converted.
Right. And that is the audience.
Yeah,
theater
is the audience.
Has a hard time, you know, bringing in the youngsters.
Exactly. Yeah.
It costs
too much.
Well, I don't know what it is, but you know, when you read about it, and I'm sure you have too, when you read about the, you know, the, whether it's the, you know, the theater of cruelty or whatever yeah. was going on, you know, with Julian Beck, or you read about even the group theater mm-hmm. you know, with these noble sort of ideas of, you know, bringing poetry and populism to the masses, there was still the old people that were shuffling in and filling up half the house
yeah.
to see the new Odette's play. I don't think I think it's romanticized. I don't think it ever had the traction. I don't. Maybe I'm wrong, though, in some theaters.
I think you're absolutely right.
But you feel like you're doing something.
You do. You feel like you're changing the world.
Yeah, and so do you feel personally that you had some effect on the decision to release Mandela from prison in the 90s?
No, because I realized that after doing it for, you know, and doing every political writer that we could lay our hands on and having actors within the group write plays,
yeah.
We made not an ounce of difference. It counted on the most right-wing, extreme Afrikaner apartheid people meeting the most extreme left-wing African National Congress people.
Yeah.
And they were the people that, you know, that's where it happened.
Sure. But
nothing to do with the liberal minority.
Right. But like, I guess on some level, though, like, and I think this is probably more important, you know, in terms of looking at it historically, you did, you know, meet different people, you did engage in different points of view,
yeah.
you did work with, you know, like, I think that sort of micro level of integrating and, yeah. and embracing and doing that kind of stuff doesn't mean nothing.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. So my education was an entire waste of time.
Well, I have to believe that, right? You have to believe on some level that, you know, if you do good things and, you know, you take chances that you know, you don't know the butterfly effect. I mean,
exactly.
Jesus. So were you doing like, you know, all the regular kind of experimental weirdness, naked plays and, you know, yelling plays. And
We did all of those things. Yeah.
You're out in the audience making them uncomfortable plays.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you never had any training.
Theater Without Walls. No, we had training.
Yeah, you did?
Three years of drama training. Yeah.
And what kind of training was that?
Based on the Stanislavski method, and they used the curriculum of, in a very colonial way, of the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London as
so
the template of what to do.
So you had the Royal Academy template and then one guy who taught method.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This is sort of a smorgasbord of stuff. So theater of cruelty, mime, restoration drama, you know, how to walk and talk, and there's also be bold enough to take all your clothes off and keep a conversation going at the same time and improvise.
Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, lots of Shakespeare.
I get a little obsessed with Shakespeare when I talk to British people.
Why?
Because I don't have the love for it that I should. And, you know, and Sir Ian McKellen sat there across from me in my old garage and did a monologue to my face.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, I get it.
Did you understand what he was saying?
I did.
Oh, that's great.
Well, that's the tricky thing is like if you listen, it's still going to be difficult, but you'll get the hang of it.
Yeah.
But if you check out for a second, you know, you're fucked.
Yeah, yeah.
You're fucked plot-wise. You're fucked story. You know,
like, be talking Mongolian.
Yeah, I don't like
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
But do you find that you understand it?
Because I grew up reading it.
Yeah.
And it was read to me. It's something that's familiar.
Yeah.
But I perfectly understand that my daughter doesn't have that.
Yeah.
Same thing. I mean, she likes going to the theater to see it, but I certainly didn't read Shakespeare to her.
Does she want to go into show business?
She is a casting director.
Well, see, that's a reasonable job in show business.
Yeah.
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 Have you had to go before her to audition for it?
She has. She got me a job in a movie called The Nutcracker.
Well, those connections really worked out for you.
She put me up for the job.
That was your
ticket.
You
didn't have to get it. Exactly. Yeah, I'm counting on that for my old age.
So you're loaded up with method, Shakespeare, and a sort of a unique racial tolerance, and you go back to Britain?
Yeah.
And what? And then what happens?
Well, when I got there in 1982, Mrs. Thatcher was the then prime minister. She decided to invade these tiny little islands called the Falklands off Argentina.
Yeah.
You know, to what effect, I have no idea.
Does anyone know?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think, you know, her polls were very, very low at that point.
Sure.
She was a great Churchillian follower, and I think she thought this would be the way that would save her bacon.
Yeah, right.
And it did.
By having a generation of people going, where?
Yeah.
That said, 82,
yes.
Thatcher.
Yeah.
You're going and you want to make a difference in England now, right?
Yeah.
You're going to jump right into the provocative theater scene.
Exactly. 25 years old. And then you find that all you can get is, you know, a job as a waiter in Covent Garden next to the Opera House. That's about as radical as you can get. So all those, you know, the ideology goes out the door because suddenly you don't have this big wall of apartheid to fight.
Right.
Because it's, you know, happening on another continent in a different hemisphere.
But you do have the fight in England, but for some reason, those fights seem less pressing.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
The fights, when people were sort of getting hot under the collar about what Mrs. Thatcher was doing compared to the Labour Party, it seemed in relation to what the atrocities and inhumanity of the apartheid system, it seemed small.
Political.
Yeah, it seemed political. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, so you were a waiter and you were like, what do I have to do? To work.
Yeah.
Enough of this ideological.
Exactly. Just get me a job.
And what was the first big acting job?
Oh, I did a lunch hour play, and then from that I got an agent, and then, you know, started doing dribs and drabs. Absolutely the classic route or route.
What's a lunch hour play?
Oh, you go.
Oh, it's soap opera?
No, it's in a pub, in a bar.
Really?
At that point you could do a play for an hour, and people used to take lunch hours, and they don't anymore.
They go to a pub to see kids.
And they'd see, you know, some young actors performing, and they get some poor agent dragged in there to come, you know, stuff their face with a sandwich and see you act and then represent you as an agent.
And then
that's how I got started.
And so then you started doing TV work or what?
No, I'm doing theater work.
Oh, it was all theater work?
Yeah, all theater work. And then I got one TV job in 1985, followed by 9 months of unemployment. And the job was with an improvised thing for the BBC with Gary Oldman, of all people. And then when it came out, the day after it came out, a year later, I got a new agent and cast in a film called With Nell and I because Daniel Day-Lewis had turned down the part.
Really?
If he hadn't, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now.
That broke you. That's like this, to this day, is a cult favorite of sorts.
It is in England.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a bit here. We have the Anglophile population. They're quiet here, but there's a lot of them. And I don't know. It is a very specific thing.
Yeah.
American Anglophiles that will just be like, oh, anything English.
They're on PBS, sort of mainlining.
Waiting, they like, are. For something.
Waiting for Downton Abbey.
Yeah, Downton Abbey. But it used to be, what, upstairs, downstairs, was it? And then Monty Python. And
exactly.
There's a Masterpiece Theater.
Anything with English people.
Yeah, they loved it. They're like, why can't we be as together as those people, proper and whatnot. But like, was With Nell, so when it came out in England, was it popular?
No, it came and went very, very quickly. And it was only as a result of being on DVD, on video and DVD and students taking it up that it then developed this cult following.
But I think that guy is interesting because he did a couple movies with him and the other movie was like amazing. Again, a cult favorite, but like, I don't know. I think everyone should see How to Get Ahead in Advertising. That thing is a crazy fucking movie, man.
Well, it's about a man who grows a talking boil on his neck.
It's so good. And when it first starts talking, it's insane.
An anti-Thatcherite rant from the director-writer Bruce Robinson.
Yep. And do you like that guy? What happened to that guy?
He lives on a farm. He's 72 years old in on the Welsh border in England.
He's out of the game?
I see him very regularly.
You do?
We stay great friends. Yep.
I think he's sort of a brilliant guy.
Yeah, he is.
Did he do a lot of work after How to Get Ahead in Advertising?
He originally wrote The Kidding Fields, which made his name and Academy nomination.
That movie, Sam Waterston, Malkovich, that was a great movie.
Yeah, great movie.
I hadn't thought about that movie in a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So he wrote that, and he recently published a book, a huge 1,200-page doorstopper called Jack the Ripper.
Is it a historical thing or is it a fictionalization?
No. He believes that he found who the real Jack the Ripper was.
And was it part of the royal family?
No, it wasn't.
Mm.
No.
I'm thinking that's a theory, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. There are so many theories, and nobody's nailed it.
And you work with, what were you in Henry and June? I remember.
I played Anais Nin's husband who had a 12-inch penis. And despite which, she went off with Henry Miller instead because he was much more interesting with a lesser-sized member.
And that was a shaved-head Fred Ward, in my recollection?
Shaved-head Fred Ward, yeah, because Alec Baldwin was going to play the part. And,
yeah.
And then he pulled out, I think, 2 weeks before we started shooting.
And Daniel Day-Lewis pulled out of With Nell.
He was offered it because he had broken America, essentially, because he played an effete Edwardian in Room of the View. And a gay punk in My Beautiful Laundrette.
Right, My Beautiful Laundrette.
And they were released on the same day, which was an absolute, just genius from his variety point of view because people couldn't believe that it was the same person.
Do you know that guy?
He was opposite absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And chose to do The Unbearable Lightness of Being instead.
The Unbearable Length of This Movie? Yeah.
So he chose to do that, and so they were scraping around, and they found a guy who'd been in one TV show with Gary Oldman, and so that's how I got to play that part.
Yeah.
Are
you friends with Daniel?
I met him on. I had a small part in Scorsese's Age of Innocence. His Warden novel, and on the first day of shooting, I prostrated myself in front of him, and I said, "Oh, Daniel, I owe you my entire career and life." And he said, "Arise, young man."
In character still.
He was not in character at that point, and then he was in character from the next day and didn't speak to me for the next 3 months. And then spoke to me on the last day that I was shooting and came out of his character. So it was an extraordinary experience.
But what do you think of people who work that way?
Well, Daniel has 3 Oscars, so you can't really, in all conscience, argue with the man's method.
But have you tried to do that? Your approach is
no. My approach doesn't do that, and I don't have any Oscars on my shelf because I think that at the end of the day, you have your own life, and you are pretending to be somebody else.
That's right, but let's not. The Oscars is somewhat of a political ordeal, and don't just talk about it like it's some sort of weird justice system. And I mean, he's a great actor. I'm not going to deny him that, but you'll get an Oscar. If you keep working and you live to about 90, they have to give you one.
Okay,
it'll happen.
well, then I've got to live for another 30 years, baby.
You can do it.
I'll keep trying my breathing.
Like, it's weird. You work with these great, you work with Coppola and Scorsese when they decided to do things that were completely different than what they had done before.
Exactly.
Where you miss the gritty sort of like, you know, hands-on guy. Yeah. In your Age of Innocence, I mean, what was like, that was like a study in table settings.
Completely.
But what was your, did you have I imagine because of, you know, Dracula, you had a bit more to do. What was it working with Coppola? Was it something?
He was like a circus ringmaster, and he likes to work in a self-confessed state of chaos where family, friends, people, dogs, music, everything is just into the mix of it. He told me the best way I understood of him, because we were rehearsing at his big estate in the Napa Valley.
Yeah.
Before we started, and I said, he said, I can't cook for two people. I can only cook for 30 people. And I thought that was exactly the metaphor for how he worked as a director.
Yeah.
Where Scorsese was the exact opposite. He worked in monastic silence. People whispered on the set. And if people whispered a little bit louder than that, he would literally blow a gasket.
No kidding.
Yeah. So it was the exact opposite. And I worked from one director to the next without, I think, a 2-week break. So it couldn't have been more extreme. And whether that was because of the subject matter of la-di-da upper class, you know, Edith Wharton Society, turn of the century in New York, or whether that's how he always is, I don't know. But Michael Bauhaus, the late Michael Bauhaus, the cinematographer on Dracula and Age of Innocence, said to me that this is how he always works.
He's got a lot going on in
quiet
his mind.
And intense.
Well, you know, with Coppola, I think there's like, pre-aging and pre-medication Coppola, and it sounds like you got in under the wire. I think something shifted in his disposition, because if you watch Heart of Darkness, the documentary, Hearts of Darkness, about making Apocalypse, it was clear that, you know, he was just like, rah!
Yeah.
So you got to experience that.
Yeah.
And Altman as well towards the end, I guess, with, that was what I was going to say, The Player, you were great in that.
Thank you.
Because, like, I think you have a knack for slightly morally bankrupt characters.
Yes.
But
this is true.
Yeah, but...
cynicism will out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But I mean, there's that moment. It was a great turn in that movie, and one of the few comedic turns in The Player was when you start out like an artist, and then
stars.
Yeah, when you come right. Yeah. That's right. No stars.
Yeah, and I've got Julia Roberts and Bruce Willis. The complete sellout.
Complete. Just like boom.
Yeah.
But what about him as a director? Because that seemed a little more controlled for him than usual, that movie.
Well, because that movie was scripted.
Mm-hmm.
And so his what he really added to that was casting everybody who was an extra as a movie actor.
Oh, really?
So that was the thing that really was the kick of that.
The Player.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but it's a great movie.
Yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved doing it. And because I'd seen Nashville 27 times when I was a theater student. So I thought that I'd never live long enough, or he would live long enough, but I'd never get the chance to work for him. And I was told when I left drama school, I looked too weird to be an actor who could make it. So I never thought that I'd work with him, and so I got three goes with him, and he was very loyal to actors, and he loved them.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, you'd think that would be the norm for movie directors, but I don't think it entirely is. But he certainly loved people, and he was very loyal.
So you did Player, Prêt-à-Porter,
and Gosford Park.
Oh, Gosford Park. Yeah. That's right. That was sort of a return to form a little bit.
Yeah, again, completely scripted with improvised bits around it. But essentially, it was Julian Fellowes' script that he had to follow.
Yeah, but they had that vibe, though. Like, that was one of those, you played the head butler guy, right?
Yeah.
But that was, it had that vibe because, you know, the difference between, you know, the serving class and the upper class, like the chatter,
exactly.
That was the play in that movie, right?
Yeah.
The way humans interacted.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was a good Altman movie. I'd forgotten that he did that.
Yeah.
A lot of directors just think like, well, we hired you to do what you do. So what do you want from me?
Exactly. Don't ask.
Yeah, just go do it. So that's,
just don't bump to the furniture. Just get on with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the norm, I would think.
I think it is, yeah.
Was that disillusioning for you initially?
It was a big surprise. And that's when your theater training comes, you know, to the fore, that you know that you've got to know all the stuff in advance and make decisions about it and not not entirely rely that the director is going to be the person who's going to provide you all the answers.
Not Daddy.
No, yeah. No. Not the Wizard of Oz, by
any
means. You pull the curtain back and you see somebody who's not thinking about the acting.
But Henry and June, you work with Kaufman.
Yes.
And he was like an underappreciated director, I think.
I think he was, yeah. I think he is. He's still
Was he engaged?
Alive. He was completely engaged. And he and his late wife, Rose, had co-written the screenplay, and they were passionate about Henry Miller. And they'd lived all their lives in San Francisco.
Yeah, right.
So they had all the sort of liberal arts credentials to take that story on.
I thought it was a pretty good movie. I want to talk a little bit about the movie that you made that I did not see.
Okay.
Because it was an autobiographical film, right? Mm-hmm. Wawa?
Yeah, and set in Swaziland, where all the stuff that I talked to you right at the beginning about.
Yeah.
And the movie opens with Miranda Richardson, who played my mother, shagging a guy that was my father's best friend. Gabriel Byrne played my father, and Emily Watson played my stepmother. So it was, and Nicholas Holt played me when I was 14 years old.
Wow.
So it was a very cathartic thing to do. It was painful to write, and then an amazingly cathartic and rewarding experience to direct, because I was going as a middle-aged person in control of 120 people, recreating
your life.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an amazing thing. Of course, egocentric in the extreme, but to do it in the actual locations where this stuff happened was really bucking the theory that you can't go back in time. And
sure.
It felt like we literally did go back in time.
And you're proud of it.
Yeah.
Was it a struggle to do?
It took 5 years, and the money fell through all the time, and we never thought it would ever get released. But got shown at the Toronto Film Festival and won awards and things. So that's... I'm just amazed that we ever got it made.
Do you direct more now?
I tried, and the other two projects that I've had have financially collapsed 3 weeks before shooting started.
Oh, my God.
So it kind of, put a dent in it for a while. So I thought, well, I'll stick to the day job.
I'm always amazed at people that do that, because it really does. If, you want to make a movie on an independent level, I mean, it could take 5-10 years of your life.
Yeah, it's masochism. I don't have that many years left. So I started making perfume instead.
I know, I read that, and I was sort of like, what is that about?
Well, there's a lifelong obsession. I fell madly in love with an American girl called Betsy Clapp, who'd arrived in Swaziland in 1969. I couldn't afford to buy perfume for her, so I made what I thought was going to be, absolute Chanel No. 5 out of gardenia and rose petals, boiled up in sugar water and buried in the garden. And, of course, it was just stink bombs. So it took me another 40 years to professionally make it. So I now made it with, lime, marijuana, mandarin. You can buy it in L.A. and you can buy it online.
What's it called?
It's called Jack, and it's unisex.
And this was not some sort of, because I was looking at that, I'm like, would a company reach out to Richard Grant? Is he got that much traction in that world?
No, I don't.
Make a cent?
Self-finance and self, the whole thing is...
This was an obsession.
Yeah. It's a one-man brand obsession.
That's insane. See, it seems like that, that somewhere in you, you're your father's son. You have a little unrequited love.
I do.
For that girl.
Clearly, yes.
What happened to Ms. Clapp?
I don't know. She left Swaziland a year later. I've never seen sight nor sound of her since.
But boy, that burying that bottle, it stuck with you.
It has certainly done.
And how's that scent selling?
Yes, done really well.
It has?
Yeah.
Well, there you go, a whole new business.
A whole new business. More reliable than trying to make independent movies.
That's insane. So, all right. I guess what people have seen in recently is Jackie. I thought that was a great movie.
Oh, thank you.
Great movie. Did you enjoy that movie?
Yeah, because I thought that Natalie Portman did an extraordinary job.
It's sort of like it's kind of a meditation on grief.
Yeah, it is.
It was really kind of a powerful, interesting movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't see Logan. I'm not a superhero guy. Was that fun?
It was very testosterized.
Yeah. Is that a lot for you on a set?
A crew of 300 people, as opposed to, working with Mariel Heller and all her predominantly female crew on how to, Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is the complete opposite of that experience.
Well, I mean, it's like, I would assume that Wolverine is the extreme example of alpha.
A crew of 300 men, and, they've all got muscles the size of, my head.
And you're the bad guy.
I was a bad guy, one of them.
Yeah. You like that?
It was fine to do.
And also I have to pay a little attention to, I'm not a Doctor Who guy, but I imagine there's a lot of people that they love you for that. You did it twice?
Yes. No, and I did a they did a radio version of it at one point. So it was never, I think it was animated with voiceover and stuff. So I played the Doctor in that, and then I played the villain in a Christmas special of Doctor Who.
Do you find a lot of people know you from that? A certain type of person?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you do Comic-Con and stuff?
I haven't, but I've heard about them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Isn't Doctor
Who? I've been invited.
Isn't that, that's that world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you won't go?
I haven't gone yet. I'm sure I will.
And what is this Star Wars business?
Star Wars business is, you know, you read, get sent a generic scene, and you self-tape, and you send it off, and you have no idea what it is. It goes out into the ether, and then 2 months go by, and your agent calls up, or my agent called up and said, they're sending a car for you to go to Pinewood Studios to meet J.J. Abrams, the director. For what? Star Wars. Right, okay. So you go in there, and he says, so you're going to do the part. You go, what's the part? And from then onwards, you sign a confidentiality treatment, and you know, you can not mention anything other than that you're in it.
Oh, so you don't know anything about it publicly?
Not at all, no, not at all. But apparently I've been doing it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and I've been costumed. And
is that exciting?
In there. It is, because it's, you go into, you know, a parallel universe. That's something that I'd seen when I was 18 years old at drama school in 1977, and suddenly you're in that place where spacey things are going on around you.
And also you're part of the history now. Yeah. You're, I mean, it's like it's a rarefied kind of, you know what I mean?
The cynical part of, you know, the terror part, paranoia part of my brain thinks, will I be in the movie when it comes out next Christmas, or will I be cut out or replaced? And that's always a possibility.
That's the problem of the acting thing.
Exactly.
But you weren't...
So I was doing stand-up Star Wars, I'd just be, you know, I'd be riffing here now for the next 2 hours.
That's right. Maybe that's it. You can still do it, man. Okay. But the new movie, I watched it last night, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And, you know, I've talked to Melissa before.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, we all know her as a comedian, you know, and this is a serious role for her.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an abrasively heartbreaking character.
Yeah.
And you, I've not seen this much of you in a long time in a movie. I mean, this is a big role.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, again, a sort of a heartbreaking, abrasive character.
Yeah.
But it was great. I really enjoyed the film, and I thought, you know, you captured that particular guy with all his flaws, you know, very perfectly.
Well, thank you. But that's entirely due to the screenplay by Nicole Hofcenter and Jeff Whitty and Marielle's direction.
And how
was working with Melissa.
And how was that working with Melissa? She's
very difficult.
Oh, no.
Yeah, she's very, very difficult. She's unkind. She's unfriendly. She never knows a line. She's always late, and she has terrible breath. It was a nightmare, frankly. But I hope you don't publish any of that.
We wouldn't dare put that on the podcast.
She was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you'd hope for. She's, you know, and I know this sounds pretentious, but I mean it very, very sincerely. She's incredibly, as you will know, sitting across from her.
Yeah.
She's emotionally present.
Oh, yeah.
She's like blotting paper. You say something to her, and you see the effect.
Right.
There's no subterfuge. There's no calculation or whatever.
Yeah.
You just feel that you're getting the genuine person. I think that is why people love her so inordinately. Yeah.
And it's interesting to see her do such a difficult and...
curmudgeon.
Yeah. And angry.
Yeah. She's an angry woman.
Yeah, I just thought the whole thing was played really nicely. That, you know, that the center, like the story itself being a true story about the, you know, this desperation that leads to this fairly, you know, gifted writer doing these forgeries.
Yeah.
And your relationship with her as her partner haphazard happens out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Because you meet in this sad, lonely kind of daytime gay bar.
Yeah.
But what I thought was interesting is that the focus never, it didn't shift to the sexuality of the thing. I mean, it was there, but it was really about the relationship with these two sort of broken, you know, desperate people that were doing what was necessary and also exciting to sort of live.
Yeah, he happens to be gay, she happens to be lesbian, and it doesn't seem to be of any real, it's not ever made into an issue movie in that way, and I thought that was a great strength to it.
Yeah, it was just is.
Yeah.
It wasn't avoided, obviously.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, the scene towards the end, where like that moment where she says, watch your house. I'm watching the movie going like, no, you can't let that guy. What are you thinking is going to happen?
Yeah.
Oh, it was so sad when she comes home.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I don't want to talk about it because that's actually a spoiler in that movie.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't want to. You watch her apartment and she comes home. It's a very sad moment. But oddly, you know, that as difficult as she was, and you know, as somewhat contemptible as your character is, you do empathize. I mean, you do at the end, you know, want them to be okay.
Yeah, and you know? I think that what Marielle Heller really did as a director was she was uncompromising about dealing with the loneliness and desperation of these people.
That, yes,
you know, it's like just muddling through life. And you know, like what John Lennon famously said just before he was murdered, that
yeah,
life is what happens in between your plans, and this is exactly what happens to these two people.
Yeah, and in the sort of the desperation and the loneliness, and you're sort of a hustler.
Yeah,
you know, and she is just desperate and bitter.
Yeah,
and it was like I think that you know oddly a lot of people can relate to that.
Yes. What is amazing about Melissa is that she just innately minds the inherent comedy of what
it is fascinating.
Is in her. That, you know, she gets laughs out of things you think, wow, on paper, is that funny?
Yeah.
But she makes it because it's, you know, it's very, very true.
It's her nature.
Yeah.
Like she can't, like, yeah, because now at this point in culture, when you see her, you're kind of like, she's going to make us. But she doesn't really do it that way.
No.
She does it very much in character. And it is a hard character. And I thought that the surrounding actors were kind of great as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like that woman who owned the bookstore.
Dolly Wells, yeah.
Wow, man. And that was shot really smartly, you know, in the sense that when she's sitting there, you can't really see how tall she is or how old she is or, where she's coming from. But then when, you know, they're out, it's like a whole different thing. And she played the vulnerability of that character. It was like devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the story is a true story. Now, when if people don't know, it's about a woman who had written successfully a couple of biographies and been on the bestseller list, but could not really make her own way writing about herself. And she was obsessed with writing about Fanny Bryce. And then somehow or another falls into forging letters of famous writers and selling them, right?
Yeah, in order to pay her rent.
In order just to survive.
Yeah, so it's a kind of act of literary ventriloquism.
Yeah. And she was successful at it because she could find the voice of these people and make it convincing.
I mean, she convinced experts that these were letters, unknown letters by Dorothy Parker, Lillian Hellman, Noel Coward, you know, great writers in her own right. And she managed to clone herself into being who they were.
Her name was Lee Shapiro. What was
Lee
her?
Israel.
Lee Israel.
Yeah.
Now, and this all happened to her. Now, when you got the script, was it offered to you? Or did you have to audition for it? Or did you, you know, when you read the material, were you like, oh, this is a great story?
I got called by an agent who said, you have 24 hours to read the script and make a decision. Start shooting in a month's time in 2 months' time in Manhattan, January 2 years ago. And I said, who has dropped out or who has died? And she said, that is not what you should be asking yourself or are you concerning with.
Yeah.
Do you want to do this or not? I said, well, who's playing the Israel? I said, Melissa McCarthy. And I thought, well, you read that.
Yeah,
because I'd seen everything she'd done, I knew that it was just a gift of a part and a gift of a role. So we jumped at it.
Anyway, those are the questions you shouldn't be asking, except it's happened to you twice, three times.
Yeah.
It's a natural. Because I know, it's so fucked up about show business. It's sort of like you get offered these things. It's like you have 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's like, how did it get to the?
How did it get to that?
To 10 minutes? Did you find out anything to make it bad for you?
No, I didn't.
Well, that's good.
And I tried to stick with the thing of not asking who or what or how who had turned it down or pulled out or whatever, because it's not good. You know, if you're given to paranoia, which I am, that's not the way to go.
But what do you do when that happens? I mean, have you found out before you started acting, and then you just compare yourself to that person?
Or yeah, I think you do.
Yeah, but you even do that.
It's like people, you know, it's like trying to ask what somebody was like, the person who you're with now, that they were stupping before. It's, you know, you may have enormous curiosity to find out about them,
but
it's best not to know and certainly not see a photograph of them.
Because
you're only going to feel probably inadequate, I think.
Yeah, I think that diminishes a little bit with age when you get a little bit of confidence. It's sort of like, all right, what am I going to do?
Yeah, but you know about confidence. It just doesn't, unfortunately, it's that sort of like juggling with jelly and water. It doesn't hold for long.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
You feel so great on one day and then somebody just comes up and sideswipes you and you're just, flattened all over again.
Yeah, or when you have to show up to do the work and you feel that heaviness, that heavy-hearted thing.
Yeah.
We're like, I'm not. I can't do it. I'm not good enough for that.
I can't go out the door.
Yeah. You get that still?
Oh, yeah. That never goes away. I just accept that that's how it is.
But do you find that, like, right when you start doing what you're doing, that it kind of...
Yeah, the terror is enormous.
Yeah. But does it diminish when you engage?
Yeah, once you start. Because, I mean, in this movie, I got to New York on a Wednesday, and I said, I think there was a plan that we were going to rehearse before we started shooting on the Monday.
Yeah.
And then I was told, you know, Melissa had been making, I don't know, 75 movies and 4 concerts or whatever she was doing, writing and publishing 3 books and launching a fashion line. She turned up on the Friday, and I begged Mariel Heller. I said, can we please just have half an hour, 10 minutes, anything, just so we meet, so that it was not on the first day having to play these people that clearly had this relationship.
Really?
So it turns out that Melissa felt the same way, and you know, we spent the whole morning going through the script and having lunch together and talking. And you know, as you know from the Malcolm Gladwell, you know, Blink book essays, that you make a decision about another human being whether you're going to get on with them or not instinctively within, you know, 15 nanoseconds.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. So, well, you have a very sort of animal instinctive response to somebody.
Yeah,
and we got on right from the get-go, and I think that that was a godsend, because it then meant that when we started work on the Monday, actual shooting, I felt like I sort of innately knew something about her.
Yeah, right.
In a way that if we'd met on the first day, my nerves would have been so shredded with jet lag and not sleeping for 72 hours, trying to get through the week and think, am I going to be fired? You know, will Mr. McCarthy hate my guts or whatever? So we'd gone through that, and we all found that we had the same idea about what this movie could and should be.
Oh, that's great. And I would think that you would have to be a real tremendous asshole for Melissa McCarthy not to like you.
Believe me. Do not be fooled.
She seems so, you know, embracing, you know?
She is.
And it was nice to see Jane Curtin, too, huh?
Yeah. Gosh, so good to see her.
And so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love when that happens.
Uncompromising and just straight down the line, being an absolute, you know.
It was great.
A gorgon.
Yeah, and there was a sort of a nice comedic balance to the thing, a little bit subtly, you know. And I like when Melissa McCarthy, I guess her husband got cast as the scumbag guy, the guy who's like, you know, shady.
Yeah. One of the autograph booksellers.
Yeah.
But you know, she essentially got the part by sleeping with him. Being a husband, because he was cast in the former incarnation of the movie.
Oh, really?
And then when that cast and director went down, he was still attached to it, and Melissa then read it, and she obviously was a fan of Nicole Hofstetter's writing. And so then Melissa got, you know, very keen on this project and kept saying, you know, this is a great character and this should get made. So she happened to be, you know, married to the guy that was cast.
Ah.
So he was the common denominator.
Yeah, they make their own movies, those two.
They do.
So Lee Israel is no longer with us?
No, she died 2014.
Did she die, you know, happier or with more money? Or what do you know?
There was a guy that was hanging around the Julius Bar, which is the oldest gay bar in Manhattan, where we were shooting, where Lee Israel parked herself regularly with headphones on and a Walkman cassette to shut the world out, but not to be harassed by people. And a guy came up to Melissa went up to this guy who was hanging around a lot and said, you know, I don't know who you are. You're on the crew or whatever.
Yeah.
He said, no, I was a friend of Lee's. And he said, it's very uncanny for me to be seeing you as Lee sitting there, because I used to sit next to her.
Uh-huh.
And she said to him, do you think Lee would have been happy with what we're doing? And his response was, happy was not really anything that Lee did. So, you know, I think that, you know,
that's
the guy
great.
That knew her, that got, who's the producer, David, who encouraged Lee to write this story eventually, about her FBI forgering life.
Yeah.
He thought that she would have been incredibly thrilled to have this spotlight on her work and her life.
Uh-huh.
So
did Melissa get her? Was...
Yeah, you read the book and you go, she's absolutely nailed who this person is.
Oh, that's great. Yep. Well, I enjoyed the movie, and it was great talking to you. Good luck with the rest of the junket.
Thank you very much.
And I look forward to seeing you in movies always.
Thank you.
That's it. That was great. I had no idea what to expect. He wanted to know a bit about me. I gave it to him, and then he told me about him, and it was an interesting story. It was unique, and I enjoyed his company. He's a very sweet guy, and great actor. Loved it. Hey, have a good weekend. Maybe I'll see you at the thing. And if not, you know, have a good time at that thing you're doing. Hey, good luck with the thing that you got going. Hope that works out. Don't worry about it. It'll be good. It'll be good. It'll be good. I will play some simple, redundant guitar now. Lives.